From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2012 in Pontevedra Beach, Florida. TPC Sawgrass hosted the inaugural Simpson Cup, a golf event that looks a lot like the Ryder Cup, with the United States taking on Great Britain. But the participants were not professional golfers. They were injured service members and veterans. Some of the participants were veterans living with PTSD and depression. Others had lost limbs. Golf's handicap system allowed them to compete directly in a show of international goodwill and as a way to raise money for veterans' causes. That first event was a success, and since then the event has rotated each year, with the United States hosting in even years, Great Britain hosting in odd years. In 2016, Oak Hill will host the Simpson Cup, and today the captains are visiting Rochester, telling their stories, getting ready for the September event. This hour we're going to talk about the Cup, but also about how veterans adjust to life with injuries or other service-related challenges. And I want to welcome my guests, including the founder of the Simpson Cup, John Simpson, is here. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Also in studio is Jim McGee, secretary of the Oak Hill Board, who can tell us how we got it here. Jim, nice to have you as well.
Thank you, Evan.
Steve Ogletree is here, the American captain. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Paul Swain's here, the UK captain. I'd say the UK. I guess Great Britain. What do we prefer?
Great Britain, I think.
Great Britain.
Better,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here
Thank
as well.
You.
And we're going to hear more about their stories in just a moment, but a brief interruption, and only a brief one, from my colleague Juan Vazquez, because we are in the middle of Pledge Week. We try not to do this very often, but it's an important week for us. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Evan. Yeah, it is an important week because when you're listening to Connections like you are right now, you're able to listen because of listener support. Folks that have called in at the toll-free number 800-295-9994 and have given their pledge of support. Folks that have called in and said, we enjoy listening to Connections. We enjoy the discourse of people being able to call in. There's not many places that you can turn on the radio or turn on our stream and listen to a topic like what Evan's about to cover and actually dive deep into it for an hour. Not only that, be a part of the conversation. We're able to do that because of listener support. You can also go online too at WXXI.org and make your pledge of support. And not only that, we reach across the Finger Lakes too, because we want to reach out to those folks. These are topics that are important to you as well. And if you're listening out in Geneva, you can log on to weos.org and make your pledge of support as well. Or if you got the phone in your hand, like most of us do, 800-295-9994 is the number, and make your pledge of support to your public radio station. Evan?
Thank you, Juan Vazquez. Thanks very much. John Simpson, I'd like to start with you. The Simpson Cup, this is its fifth iteration now. And how did this come about? Why did you want to create an event like this?
Well, it all came about that I spent my 14th year in hospital with polio and an operations on my leg that left me with a limp. And it was the end of my sport as I knew it. And golf is the only game that you can play if you're handicapped or disabled in any way on the level playing field with able-bodied people. I then started this charity because I was asked to visit the British Military Rehabilitation Center in Britain. And when I saw what I saw and the number of veterans and their age, I thought it's a great opportunity of starting a charity, which we call the On Course Foundation, which is teaching golf to injured current and ex-servicemen and women, with the key of then getting them employment, either part-time or full-time employment within the golf and related industries. And the Simpson Cup simply was an event we created for the guys and girls to play towards and to introduce a bit of competition to them. And it's basically a fundraiser for the charity and also to raise awareness for the charity.
2012 was the first iteration, and in 2016, Oak Hill will host 13 on 13, is that right? How many players on each side?
Yeah, it's 12 on each team. We have one chap or a girl who would will play one, be like a substitute, but will definitely play one of the matches.
And how do they play their way onto these teams?
Well, there's qualifying, and then the two captains here have some picks as well. So they've got some, I mean, I must say the American team is already looking very strong, and so I think the Brits have got a bit of a game on their hands, I would say.
Well, that's generous of you. And let's talk to the captains who are here in Rochester today. Steve Ogletree, the American captain, who is, first of all, Steve, as the captain, you are going to be playing, yes?
I am, and I'm thrilled to and honored to have this position to represent the United States this year in the Simpson Cup. Mr. Simpson said, I mean, we're looking strong on paper. We just need to go out there and physically do it.
Well, very good. Well, tell us a little bit about your service, if you could, Steve.
I am a 21-year veteran of the United States Army. I enlisted in 1988. I had a stint in Somalia in 1993. It took until 2008 for this traumatic experience to finally break me down. And I was hospitalized in 2008 at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And there I discovered anxiety, depression, PTSD, all of these things were diagnosed. And while being in the hospital, I was told that I needed to find an outlet and to get out and to do some things. And I thought about golf, and I was introduced to golf in a serious way. I had played around with it, but I wasn't too serious about it, but I was introduced to golf in a serious way. And I got into it, and I came across a friend, Chris Bowers, who participated in the first Simpson Cup, and he asked me, did I know anything about it? I said, no. He said, well, I'm going to give you an application. The application came back from the UK approving me to play, and here we are today. I'm the United States captain for 2016. It's an honor, first of all, and it's a great accomplishment for
me. Well, sure. And you got, so you say those diagnoses started for you in 2008, right?
2008. I can remember as far as 93 and 94 being told I need to go to the doctor. But you know, when you're in the military, you have somewhat of tough skin, and you don't want to be the weak one. So we try to deal with it. A great number of people want to try to deal with a situation that they know they have without getting help. And I went all those years of dealing with it until it finally just broke me down to the point I had to be hospitalized. And it really took a toll on me. And people do not realize that, you know, I don't have a missing limb, but inside there is a war going on all the way from 1993 until right now, today, 2016. And it's managed both by things like the Simpson Cup, my family, medication. And I myself, through my job, I try to reach out to other vets and give back and try, you know, to let them know that it's okay to tell someone that you have PTSD. Don't be ashamed of it. And it can be controlled.
Absolutely. I very powerful stuff, Steve. And you, when you say that you felt broken down by it, was there a moment for you where you felt like you didn't have a choice, that you hospitalization was going to happen? What was the low for you?
The low point came to me. I had gone to work. I was still in the military, and I was really in a bad situation. To describe it as not sleeping, not caring about anything, my job or anything, neglecting my family. And I had spoken to a doctor, and I had somewhat of a relationship with him. So this particular day, I was going home, and I felt really bad, and I called the doctor, and I told him what was going on, and he said, do not go home. He said, turn around, turn your car around, and come straight to emergency room. He said, I should have gotten off at 3 o'clock today, but I'm still here, and I will stay here until I get you some help and admitted into the hospital.
Was he scared for what was going to happen?
He was scared in a way that he didn't know what I wanted to do. The questions that he asked were, are you feeling like you want to hurt yourself? And I didn't feel like I want to hurt myself. I just had anger toward other people, per se. I knew I had my family at home, and I loved them, you know, but it's just the anger inside of me just will not let me rest. And this doctor got me admitted into the hospital, and that's where I found solace, you know. It took me 2 weeks to sit down and really think about what had happened to me and to accept the fact that my life has changed and it will always be changed, and I need to figure out a way to manage it.
I think you're telling the story of probably tens of thousands of veterans who've been through the same. So before I turn to the Great Britain captain, I just want to ask you, Steve, how you're doing now, because you mentioned that there's a lot in your life that is helping you work through this. And this PTSD, this anxiety is part of you. But you also mentioned medication for people who have depression. I know people in my own life who have depression, and there are times where they feel like, I'm managing this. I'm good. I don't need to be on meds anymore. As you said, sometimes for whatever reason, it makes people feel weak, and it shouldn't, but some people do that, and they say, I'm going to go off the meds. Have you been able to sort of stay pretty steady, and are you feeling pretty good these days?
To you and the rest of the listening audience, it is a real challenge to continue the meds. Depending on the type of medication that an individual is taking, me myself, my meds are extremely powerful, I'd say, to give it a short term. And it has taken me 3 or 4 weeks to get used to it. I just told Mr. Simpson this morning, it's funny you asked that, my wife wants me to get off the medication. And, you know, I explained to her, I cannot get off this medication because it's designed to get me in a position where I can manage this depression and PTSD every day. If it gets to a point where it's doing something that is harming me or have an effect where I can harm someone else, then I think we need to talk to the doctor and get me on something else. But I would say, in the long run, anyone that has been, you know, prescribed this medication, do not get off of this medication. This medication is designed to put you in a position to manage what you're dealing with. And this medication has side effects. You can't just get off of this medication. You have to gradually decrease the dosage and monitor what you're doing to completely get off of this medication. And that includes dealing with your physician. And again, I would stress, do not get off this medication. It's designed to help you.
Well, congratulations on your success. I hope you get out there and birdie the first and win 10-8 your first match.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to talk to Steve Ogletree, the American captain. Paul Swain is the captain for Great Britain. And, you know, Paul, it's interesting. You know, Steve mentioned how PTSD has impacted him and how he said he didn't lose a limb, but he's got a war going on inside him. You, in contrast, lost a limb. And why don't you tell us about your service and your story?
Yeah, okay. Just before I start, I just want to say that I really hope Steve doesn't go out and do 10-8 win. The complete opposite would be nice.
Well, that's all right. It's all in goodwill. It's all in goodwill.
It is. Yeah, so I joined the Army in 1995. I followed my brother's footsteps. And, you know, back then the conflicts weren't really going on. Maybe Northern Ireland, the odd Bosnia. But I worked my way up the ranks. I was fortunate enough to play sport at very high level, boxing, soccer, basketball, golf. And I served in different countries. So I was in Kosovo, where I seen some not so nice things over there. And I went to Iraq, and we lost guys there as well. And my final deployment was in Afghanistan in 2011. And it was my job to teach and mentor the Afghanistan army. And on this particular patrol, we were forcing the Taliban out of the villages, quite offensive. And my interpreter stepped out of a safe zone and initiated a device. And unfortunately, I was next to him. It killed him outright. So I lost my left arm, damaged all my entire left side, and a bit of internal organ damage. So I mean, even to this day, it's quite difficult to talk about. You can imagine you're kind of up and down with the emotions, but you know, that happened, and I just remember being in the hospital and thinking, I've gone from having all this camaraderie, the teamwork, the banter, the leadership, the discipline, to nothing overnight, you know, and being in the hospital bed every night and just thinking, looking down at my arm when everyone's left, the family's left, the close friends, and just thinking, what do I do now, you know, where's my self-worth? But, you know, I was fortunate enough, I got introduced to John Simpson about 6 months after I was injured, and, you know, things just turned around for me then, because you develop these relationships and they're for life, because the military is like none other job out there. You know, it's all about cohesion and watching each other's backs, and to be taken away from that in the click of a finger was very difficult. But John brought me on board, and, you know, I went to some of the 3-day events which they do in the UK, and I started to meet like-minded people again, people that have been in similar circumstances. And it just went from there, and the confidence started to build, and the leadership again, and the teamwork, leadership to a certain extent, and the teamwork. And I've been very fortunate enough to be involved in all of the Simpson Cups to date. I was in the first one. I got the winning putt for the GB team. I thought I'd like to get that one in on radio. And then the second one, I got the winning putt for the GB team. So I put myself in a good position. I'll say that just to continue with the Simpson Cup. And the On-Course Foundation is just, you know, it's just amazing what they do, because not only do they bring you together and get you playing golf, which is the only sport you can play on the level playing field,
sure,
regardless of disabilities, but they also introduce you to the work related industry, which I think is key. And I've been fortunate enough to also be exposed to all of that. So the friendships are good, and I've met a lot of the American guys, and, you know, we're close friends now. And, you know, I think this is something that's definitely here for the long term, and I hope that, you know, this kind of thing goes on for many years to come.
Paul, you know, I don't want to be trite. I mean, there's nothing I could say that could possibly explain how much I admire not only your recovery from the bomb blast and from losing a limb, but from someone who has obviously been in athletics most of your life, right? Hmm. Having to learn how to do things with one arm. Did you play golf before that accident?
Not much at all.
Okay.
No, I played a little bit as a youngster, but not in the military days.
How has it been learning to play with one arm?
Tough. Yeah, I think initially it was just, again, John took me up to somewhere in the northwest of England and sort of took me under his wing, as he does with all the guys. And I just, the first, you know, few days, I just thought, you know what, I don't really want to get involved with it, because I was competitive, and I still am. And I just couldn't hit the ball, really. But, you know, you just got to persevere, be patient, and you get the support from the guys that are around you. And before long, you know, I was hitting it pretty good, and I managed to get my handicap down. So I think you just, it's one of those things, isn't it? You kind of go one way or the other. I mean, life's not perfect for anybody, regardless of what condition you're in. So you just got to try and see the positives, and that's what I'm trying to do, and playing pretty good.
Amazing. I'm going to run out of time, but I just want to briefly ask you, apart from sport, apart from golf, what's been the hardest adjustment for you since the injury, since losing the limb?
That's a tough one, really. I think day-to-day things around the house can be quite difficult, because I've not got a partner. So I've not got anyone to sort of fall back on or help me in that side of things. So I think just day-to-day stuff, washing the pots, anything like that, you know, washing the clothes, is quite difficult. But again, you just find a way, or you ask your friends and family. So you just, you know, you've got no choice, really, so you just got to get on with it.
Paul, I'm sort of hoping you birdie the first and you win 10-8 as long as you're not playing Steve.
Nice.
I really admire your story, and I know everyone here is glad to have you. Jim McGee is the secretary of the Oak Hill Board. And just real briefly, Jim, since we don't have a whole lot of time left here before we have to get to our half-hour break here, how did Oak Hill end up with this event?
Well, it started in 2010. I was on a golf trip, and part of that trip was a group of wounded veterans. And after spending 5 days with them listening to stories similar to Steve and Paul, I became affected with a cause. Skip forward to the time of Craig Harmon's retirement. I was part of the search committee. In doing that, I learned that Jason Ballard, the new golf professional at Oak Hill, had been doing things with veterans in his stint at Congressional and at Augusta. And as soon after he was hired, he knew about my past experience doing some private, quiet things in town. And we got together and said, we have to bring something to Oak Hill. Didn't know what that was at the time. And we did some research, heard about what was going on at Congressional in 14, the Simpson Cup. I encouraged Jason to attend and find a way to meet John Simpson and encourage him to take a look at Oak Hill. Long story short, John was thrilled at the fact that Oak Hill would want to do this. And really it boiled down to, we have all this history of majors and doing things in our legacy, but here was an opportunity on a international stage to say thank you to veterans for all their sacrifice and commitment in their families, and do it for nothing more than that.
All right, and so the event, the actual Simpson Cup, is going to be in September, yes?
September 18th.
September 18th.
It starts, and there will be 2 days. The first 2 days, one is some activity with the members. The next day would be some sponsors activity, and then the matches.
And, you know, I suspect a lot of people would like to see it, but is the audience limited to veterans who want to come out? How does that work?
Right now, we decided to limit it just to the veterans and their families and guests of sponsors and members, and focus on the veterans in the community.
Sure.
Because what we didn't want to do is lose sight of what we were intending to do.
Well, it's going to, I know that they're going to have a memorable time in September. John Simpson, before we let you get back to Oak Hill, the founder of the Simpson Cup, these are just two stories, mm-hmm. Steve and Paul, reminding us what veterans around the world have been going through. For you, in meeting and working with the men and women who played in this event, and in the veterans that you have met who've gone through what they've gone through, are you still as touched as I was just listening to these kind of stories?
Yeah, very much so. And everybody has their own story. And I suppose the word that comes out is just proud. I'm so proud of them. And to see them almost down in the dumps and come through this great game of golf and self-confidence and self-esteem they get from that and the camaraderie, and then hopefully go on to employment. So I'm very proud of them all.
Are you all playing Oak Hill today? Are you playing Oak Hill today?
We're going to visit shortly, but we've not played yet. I don't think Steve's played either, have you?
No, I haven't played it.
I don't remember what happened in the 95 Ryder Cup. We've lost the tape. I think the United States was doing well right toward the end. But we'll see what happens in the Simpson Cup in September. We've got to get a short break. They've got to get back to Oak Hill. And when we continue the conversation, we're going to talk more broadly about veterans' issues and all of the things sort of surrounding this newish and great event. John Simpson, thank you for being here. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
And cheers on the wonderful success so far. Jim McGee, thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Taking the time to come in. And Steve and Paul, the captains, good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
On the course and off. Thank you very much. Short break. More connections coming. Coming up in our second hour, we talk to the executive director of the Christian Educators Association International. Part of their mission is training public school teachers to share their Christian values in schools without crossing legal lines. They advise teachers on how to share their faith in public school settings without proselytizing. Are you comfortable with the arrangement? We'll talk about how they're working next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And before we continue with our discussion, we want to bring Juan Vazquez, my colleague from down the hall, right back into the discussion real briefly. Hi, Juan.
Hello. You said they got to get to Oak Hill. Can we go? It's a nice day for it, isn't it?
Sir. Yeah, well, it is beautiful and great for them, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a great half hour so far. We've got another half hour to come, and this is going to be a very good and prominent half hour on the topic that Evan's going to be talking about. It's just one of the many topics that we touch on here on Connections. Every single weekday between noon and 2, we're able to bring these topics to you. We're able to bring the show to you and have you be a part of the conversation, which there's a lot of shows now that you're not able to be part of the conversation. You just listen, you take in the information. But here, you actually get to be a part of it. You get to be a part of it by calling in and also making your financial support to your public radio station to make sure that this show continues on. You can do that by calling 800-295-9994. That's 800-295-9994 to make your pledge of support. You're listening in Rochester. You can make your pledge of support over at WXXI.org. And for those listening in Geneva and in the Finger Lakes, you can head on over to WEOS.org and make your pledge of support.
Thank you, Juan.
Thank you.
SimpsonCup.com if you want to check out more information on it. I'm joined now by Jeremy Bagley, the executive director of JDRF Rochester and a 10-year veteran of the United States Army. Jeremy, welcome. How are you?
Evan, pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, first of all, this event, I think, is new to a lot of our listening audience. It was new to me until we learned more about it from the participants today. Really inspiring stories from veterans. What's your role in all of this?
About 3 years ago, as Jim was talking about in the first half hour, Oak Hill decided that they wanted to get on board with the Simpson Cup and bring that here, showcase our community. And one of the things that the Simpson Cup, John and Ben Simpson wanted to do was get a better picture in the communities that they were having these events in for what veterans programs were and the services for veterans and their families. And as you and I and many of your listeners both know, we can talk about the economy and jobs and those numbers go up and down. But one of the things that Rochester has always had is this amazing philanthropic spirit and essence to it. And that exists tremendously in our veterans community, where we have some of the top-ranked veterans programs, not in the state, not in this part of the United States, but in the country. And that was something that both Ben and John Simpson and Oak Hill graciously offered for us to be able to broadcast to a worldwide audience.
You are a 10-year veteran of the United States Army.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about your service.
I graduated from Arkport Central School down in Arkport, New York, about 60 miles south of here. About 3 weeks after graduation, I packed up all my Pabst Blue Ribbon cans and went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where I was part of the United States Army and the Field Artillery Branch. I got the pleasure in the first part of my career to go to Germany, Korea, all over the world. After 9/11, we started going to places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And then I got out 2004-2005 time frame, and have been happy to have Rochester as my home for the last decade plus.
You have been working on, from my perspective, some very interesting things here, and I want to ask you about some of them, including One Team, One Fight, the reintegration of post-9/11 female veterans through community connectedness. Tell me about that. What is it?
Absolutely. It was great. I was got an opportunity to use the post-9/11 GI Bill to go back to college. And what I wanted to do was write about veterans programs. At the time, I was working as the director for Veterans Affairs at Nazareth College and had a really good eye-opening experience there where many of our male veterans came in and I had a plethora of services to be able to introduce them to. Our women veterans would come in and I would scratch my head a little bit on where I could send them, who I could have them talk to, and obviously we share a service background, completely different or many different things when it comes to gender. So we interviewed 200 women veterans locally, all the way back from Korea through the post-9/11 era, and just got some insights from them on what they needed, what they weren't getting, how they felt about using veteran services, how they felt about using the veteran services offices, and really got an insight to how we as a community, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to have veteran services in your title. You can volunteer and help out vets, not just female veterans, but all veterans, help them reacclimate back into society. And it was a great program. All said and done, we realized that it does take that whole village to help bring those folks back.
Okay. What have you learned since the start of this effort?
What we've learned is that we've got a lot of people out there with some amazing good intentions, and it does take a unified group. We like to call it a seamless network of service providers. The Veterans Outreach Center down on South Avenue does some amazing things. And then there's some other things that they can't do. They've got a limited amount of staff. You know, there's a footprint. So we can partner them up with the Veterans or Department of Veterans Affairs. Laura Stradley through the Monroe County Veterans Services Agency does some amazing things over there. And we said to ourselves, if we're not talking, if we don't have any idea what each other's organizations do, then what is a veteran just coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan going to experience? So now we meet regularly, we plan events together, we have this collaborative called One Team, One Fight, and we have a working group with Help Base Greater Rochester. And we're working hard to be better at who we are to serve those who worked very hard to serve us.
Talking to Jeremy Bagley, the executive director of JDRF Rochester. Why don't you tell me about, by the way, the acronym or what it stands for and what you're serving now?
Well, yeah, I'm working for JDRF Rochester, which is the Rochester chapter. We go from Rochester all the way down to Elmira for juvenile diabetes. And I know that may be an interesting off topic while we're talking about veteran services. But again, it's just part of being able to give back. I love my job and what I do, but I will always have a passion for and want to be serving vets with the people in this community.
You heard in the past half hour, you heard the stories of Steve and Paul. Very different in terms of how they were impacted by their service. Steve said, I thought it was so interesting, Steve sitting next to Paul. Paul has one arm, and Steve says, I'm not somebody who lost a limb like Paul, but every day since 1993, there's a war raging inside me. And that he tries to cope with that in many different ways. You are somebody who served in operations Iraqi and Enduring Freedom, right?
Yes, sir.
In combat. And you've seen things that a lot of us have never seen. Everybody is impacted differently. First of all, what did you make of some of Steve's comments about not just PTSD, but depression and anxiety that goes with it?
I think the thing about Steve that just kind of gets everybody emotionally, everyone that was here in the room, and I'm sure your listeners, is that internal conflict. You know, PTSD is not something that is intrinsic or based just in military service. People are traumatized in their home. They're victims of crime. But I think that we often identify, you know, people with Purple Hearts and Medals of Honor, and those things are amazing things, but we don't really focus on what's going on internally. So if we can't see it, it probably didn't happen, and especially with somebody in a uniform. And, you know, to Steve's point, you know, this is something that's been just pounding away at the inside of his head for the last 20 years. Anybody who serves in a military situation where you're deployed overseas comes back with that. And I know the VA estimates about 10 to 15% have a debilitating form of PTSD. But anyone who's in that environment has some form of it. It's just how they're coping with it. For myself, I had the ability to be able to rationalize that what has happened to me or what I've seen happened thousands of miles away in a place that I don't ever have to go back to. And I had a great support group. My mom and dad are amazing people. My father had served. He understood. And we had candid conversations. And I think for a lot of folks, what Steve said about, you know, he didn't want to look weak. You know, he didn't want to go ask for help. You look so much stronger and you make your life so much better when you do break down that wall and ask somebody for help and admit it. And it doesn't have to be a family member. The best service people I know have never been in the military, but they listen. And I think that's what somebody's looking for that's been in that type of a scenario, is somebody who will listen.
Have there been moments for you where you know you find yourself thinking of what you experienced, wishing you could sort of put it away? You seem to have been compartmentalizing this remarkably well.
I think that there's days that you have let it build up and then it may manifest itself in a car ride home. Someone cuts you off and you just start pounding the steering wheel uncontrollably. I don't think that those things are necessarily something that is native to people who serve in the military. But there's times, you know, the first few years I had trouble sleeping. Again, I didn't have a ton of this, you know, Rambo envisioned, you know, combat experience.
Sure.
But enough bombs and missiles going off to think about it, or when fireworks go off to get a little sketchy about it when in the beginning. But, you know, I think the compartmentalizing helps to a certain extent. And I'm not a mental health professional, but from my own experience, I know that that's worked for me with talking about it. You know, to be able to rationalize that this isn't something that I'm ever going to have to go through again, but need to talk about it all the same. And both Steve and Paul, I think, said it perfectly. That's different for each person who goes in. Just like every snowflake's different, everybody who serves in the military, anybody who goes through trauma from a car accident or, you know, any type of trauma deals with it differently. That just happens to work for me. It works differently for people all over the world.
We've had conversations in the last 2 years about mental health and the way our society, I think, is starting to move, I feel like moving a glacier, but starting to understand that mental health, you said it well, just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not real. But for many years, we kind of separated it from physical health challenges. It was mental health and physical health, and now we're kind of bringing it together. Paul sits next to Steve. You can see it. Paul doesn't have a left arm. Steve, you can't see until he tells you about it. But how do we get to a point as a society where we don't sort of effectively downgrade the seriousness of what Steve is dealing with just because we can't see it?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think, you know, there's a certain machismo factor that goes with serving in the military, and that goes for both men and women. I think that that's something that is a micro in the military sense, but a macro problem for our country. We often think of, you know, rub some dirt on it or, you know, suck it up and drive on when it comes to people expressing any type of mental health anguishes they have. I think that someone said it very well once, you know, you wouldn't make fun of somebody who had cancer. And mental health is a disease and an illness in every vein that any other type of disease like cancer may be. I think as a collective conscious, we have to get to the point where we realize that when bad things happen to you, it has more of an impact than just on your body. And the brain is one of the most important organs you've got. If we're not taking care of that, we're not taking care of the rest of ourselves.
Now you are, well, let's see here. You hold a bachelor's degree from Fisher and pursuing a doctorate, yes?
Yes, sir.
And writing about what's going up? What's happening right now, right, with the Simpson Cup?
I'm writing about the Simpson Cup. I got my the syllabus for the entire 2 years of this program, and one of the options was to go out and find somebody in the community who was in a leadership role. I had worked with Jim McGee from Oak Hill previous to this. Jim had mentioned during the last half hour that we'd brought some golfers up to Oak Hill. One of them was Chad Pfeiffer, who was on the Golf Channel's Big Break, and he shot a 71 at the East Course a few weeks before Tiger Woods and the rest of them went out there and shot a 78 and 79. So, he was a double below the knee amputee. He was using some amazing adaptive access technology, very much what's being designed over at RIT and from the L. Siegel Center. And went out there and cranked the 71 out, and I shot that on the first nine, which was, you know, pretty funny. He didn't have any sympathy for me, though. But the Simpson Cup and where we're at with that is a lot of fun. Again, going back to what I talked about before, John is a very gracious man in founding this and really wanted to immerse our community in this. We wanted to take that one team, one fight model we have of all the organizations working together and being networked and see how from a veteran services side we could provide the type of audience and the type of program that they wanted to have at the Simpson Cup. So we're not going to just go out there and have some great golf from some of the best adaptive sports golfers in the world. We're also going to go out there and network veterans in with folks who are looking to hire them. We're looking to our point earlier, get them connected with mental health professionals if they're interested in that. We're going to have folks from the VA, the Veterans Outreach Center, CDS Monarchs, Warrior Salute Program, 10 agencies out there that really get them immersed in our community. And if we're using golf as a lead blocker for that or sports as a lead blocker for that, then great. You know, more power to us for it.
And what kind of writing? I mean, I guess it's a thesis. Are you writing a thesis on Simpson Cup?
I am. This is for executive leadership. Type of a doctorate. So I won't be like the kind of person who can stop on the side of the road and help anybody out or render aid, but I will be able to pontificate about executive leadership. And this is all where we document everything. I was taking photos in the first half hour of these amazing guys, Paul and Steve, cataloging everything, the logistics that are going into it, the fundraising aspect of it. There's about five or six individual spheres for this event that make it happen. And obviously, we've got a worldwide television audience on the Golf Channel here and on Sky TV over in the UK that are going to be watching this. So just writing about all the logistics that are going into it, how it was formed, what the teams are, how they were composed, and really just, you know, bringing in sponsorships as far as how we're doing that and how we're networking with that and mashing that all up together into a 356 pages that I'll submit for a review by amongst academics.
I was looking over at Paul, the captain, and I'm just trying to picture him on the first tee at Oak Hill or anywhere swinging with just his right arm and he's pounding it out there now. I mean, he's a very fit guy. You can look at him and you can tell Paul's an athlete.
Right.
But, you know, you've probably met plenty of veterans who have readjusted to life as best you can when you do lose a limb, when you lose an arm, when you lose a leg. And I can't even imagine what that's like, let alone competing in an international event the way Paul is. Tremendous, isn't it?
It's great. And, you know, we have some fine examples of that. We've got a program down in Canandaigua called Oasis Adaptive Sports. They run about 12 different programs, everything from boating, rowing. They have a golf team. And they're showing people how, through the use of access technology and a lot of hard work and determination, that folks like this or anyone who's missing a limb can come back and really have a healthy, active, and productive life.
Richard writes to the program and says, my own PTSD has been most effectively helped by a chiropractor who works with network spinal analysis. And Richard, I think that's great. I mean, to hear of all the different approaches out there, it at least starts with confronting it and acknowledging it. So if you've been listening to the program, as we've been talking about the Simpson Cup and the ways that they're trying to help veterans in our community, where would you have people start, Jeremy, especially if they need to start somewhere in terms of getting services? You mentioned Veterans Outreach does a lot. They can't do everything. Where would you have people start?
Well, we're trying to narrow down the entry points because we often talk about the fog of war. Well, there's a fog of being a veteran. You've got 20 or 30 people from 30 or 40 different organizations often jumping up and saying, come over here, come over here. And we're trying to work with, I think Todd Baxter's done a great job of taking the Veterans Outreach Center to a whole new level. They're working to be the premier agency for in-processing veterans. We also have Laura Stradley, who is amazing at the Monroe County Veterans Services Agency. So if you're listening with inside the airwaves of this station, I would recommend hitting those two places first for just a complete triage of what you may need. And the great thing about the partnerships that all of our organizations have with those two agencies is that then they can filter you out to any one of those supporting agencies.
Joe on Twitter writes, I don't know if your guest can speak to it, but I find that dissociative disorders are often forgotten about as well.
Yeah, I would very much agree with that. You know, one of the things that I learned about when I was doing the research on women veterans, especially as it comes to that type of vein, was that a lot of them weren't going out and getting the benefits that they needed or getting the healthcare services that they needed because they no longer wanted to associate themselves with military or veterans things. And it was all this block because they had been sexually harassed or assaulted, verbally harassed on a day-to-day basis, and they no longer wanted to go into an office that looked like what they had seen in the military. And about 20% of the women that I talked to just said, you know what, I would rather not have the benefits or the health care to not have to go through that again.
We're talking for a few more minutes here, and let me kind of reset and address this because I got an email from Mark who just said, Evan, you mentioned Simpson Cup. Could you explain again what is it and can we attend? I guess it depends, Mark. I don't know about your background, but the event is coming up in September. In the middle of September, Oak Hill Country Club is hosting the Simpson Cup. This will be the fifth edition. You probably have heard of the Ryder Cup, and this is a kind of Ryder Cup for veterans, American and from Great Britain. And Oak Hill is hosting. The United States has been hosting in even-numbered years, and the UK hosting in odd-numbered years. Oak Hill stepped in for this event, but it is not going to be one of these events that is a big open gate to the public, tickets for everyone. Jim McGee mentioned earlier that if you are a veteran, you and your family may be able to attend, Jeremy?
Yeah, what we're going to do, and again, we talked about the partnership with the Veterans Services Agencies, each one of the VSOs is going to be responsible for bringing in a certain amount of people to this event, just so we can keep a control list of who's going to be there. Obviously, we want to make sure we take care of any security concerns for an event this big. So if the gentleman who emailed you wants to reach out to Veterans Outreach Center, myself, I can give you my email. It's jbagley@jdrf.org. Again, JDRF isn't a veteran services agency, but I'm handling all the at-large veterans who may want to attend. We'll put you into a database. We'll have a ticketing system available that we're working on with the IVMF, the Institute for Veterans and Military Families at Syracuse University. And we'll make sure that any veteran and their family member who's eligible will get a ticket and a lanyard that identifies them by their service. like to create a little organic networking at the event as well.
SimpsonCup.com's got some photo galleries. There's some pretty intense, some pretty cool looking moments there.
Those guys don't mess around. I mean, yeah. You saw Paul, his arm, his one arm was the size of two of mine. So
seriously.
I would not mess with Paul. Paul, he can win an 8 and 10 or 50 and 60 or whatever he wants to do. I'm not getting in that guy's way.
I want to get one more email from, this is from Allison, who just says, Evan, thanks for addressing these many issues, but you're so far missing the elephant in the room, and that is that we have an epidemic of veteran suicide. Please bring this up. We must do something to stop it. That's
I think that is a great way to kind of build up the staircase to everything that we've just been talking about. To her point, statistically, we talk about 22 veterans every day decide that this is the juncture that they want to take their own life. And that is something that we have all worked on locally very hard to try to prevent. It's something that goes back to what we talked about with talking about things. I think for myself, I might not have been in that type of a scenario, but if I hadn't had that network of people to talk to, if I hadn't lived it like I do in a community of Rochester where I could get the help I need, 8 years ago, I kind of just said, forget it. And I was living from cruddy apartment to cruddy apartment. I went to the Veterans Administration and was treated for bed bugs. I just had kind of given up.
Wow.
And it wasn't until somebody there just sat down with me and said, you just need a friend. You need somebody to talk to. And they really helped me out. When we hear all this bad stuff about the VA, I think that what we've got to do is really usher in this mental health conversation that we talked about earlier. That 22 deaths a day is unacceptable for a country that puts as much money into the military and veteran services as we do. But we have to initiate a conversation. And so I would challenge your listeners back with, if you know somebody who's in the military and you don't want to get too invasive about what their experiences are, just ask them how they're doing. I wouldn't even say that just about the military. Ask anybody about that. If you see somebody who's down in the dumps, just having a bad day, we're all human beings. We got one shot at floating around this big mud ball together. Let's just take care of each other a little bit more. And that could speak to the micro of veterans and military services, but it really speaks to a macro of who we are as just a species.
All right. Finally, you mentioned the VA. Does it get an unfairly bad rap?
I would say, and without compromising my friendships with my friends at the Department of Veterans Affairs, I think that the problem with the VA is that it's too much of a patchwork quilt. We have amazing services here in Rochester. The folks in the Canandaigua VA are some of the best in the country. As you've seen from news stories, sometimes that level of service isn't there everywhere. So Phoenix, I've had that scandal that they had. We've seen news stories from other cities and communities. We're very fortunate here to have a great leadership group who has kind of broken down that institutionalized wall and said, we need our community partners to help us out. We need you to be part of who we are at serving veterans. And so to give a long answer to a short question, if it was consistent across the board, the VA would be the best run bureaucracy in the world. If the standards that were happening in Canandaigua and the outpatient center in Rochester were just mimicked across the country, I don't think we'd be having this conversation.
At the very least, though, it sounds like locally you like what you've seen.
My experiences with the VA here have been tremendous. I know that there's going to be random, callers and emails who say that.
Sure.
No, but mine have been tremendous.
Okay, very good. Well, it's been an eye-opening conversation this hour as we talk about the Simpson Cup. And if you missed any of that, it's SimpsonCup.com. And Jeremy Bagley has been here helping us understand all of the different groups that are going to be benefiting from this. Also mentioned the OnCourse Foundation, which we should let you know as well. That is something that John Simpson was talking about. And my guess is that's much more out of your hands, but still worth kind of looking up and researching and understanding what they do, yes?
Absolutely. And they were generous enough to say that no matter what we raise, we're leaving a certain percentage of it here in Rochester. So we appreciate John, Ben, the entire OnCourse Foundation for what they're doing for us and the awareness for this cause.
And my understanding is that Oak Hill is really laid it out as well. I mean, donate is a fair word. They're not only donating the space and the course, but they're making sure that organizations can get some help locally as well. Yes,
absolutely. And they're bringing in some amazing speakers who I won't reveal right now because I don't want to ruin it.
Okay.
But they're going to show and have a world-class party for a bunch of people who really deserve it. It's an awesome thing.
Jeremy Bagley is the executive director of JDRF Rochester and a 10-year veteran of the United States Army. I know you're having fun with this, and the community is going to enjoy it. Thanks for coming in and telling us more about it, and good luck with everything that's all the way leading up to September.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
All right, short break. Much more Connections coming up.